Welcome to the TFD Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan, and this is the show where we break down popular science into easily digestible and actionable information to give you the blueprint to be a high performer in your life. Today, I'm joined by one of the best grapplers in the world and definitely one of the biggest personalities in the world of jiu-jitsu, Craig Jones. Craig is an Australian grappler who is an IFBJJ and Polaris world champion and two-time ADCC silver medalist. He used to train with the Danaher Death Squad before their infamous split, and he has since started the B-Team, which resides in Austin, Texas. In this episode, Craig and I dive deep into the crazy world that is ADCC and talk about what really goes on behind closed doors at the world's biggest jiu-jitsu competition. We talk about the creation of the B-Team and what it is like seeing his former coach and teammates at events. We talk about the culture of jiu-jitsu and why steroids are so prevalent, and we finish off by discussing dieting habits in the jiu-jitsu world and why so many athletes get it wrong. This is a really cool podcast, so let's get to it.
All right, welcome to another episode of the TFD Performance Podcast. So joined by a man who does not do too many podcasts, Mr. Craig Jones.
What's going on? Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, of course. But I want to start this off because I just experienced one of the weirdest things. Now, I get to hang out with a lot of what I would call very famous athletes, and I just experienced one of the weirdest things that I've never, ever seen. We're obviously in an Airbnb here. We're not going to disclose the location because of this. And if you're listening to this, I don't want you to take offense to it, but we were just sitting here, front door bangs, and we've got a Craig Jones fan who just waltzes into the house.
Yeah, we're still not sure how he found out I was here.
Like, literally, we were here for probably, I'd say 10 minutes, and then somehow someone's figured out where Craig. I'm actually nervous recording this that we're going to get interrupted by someone coming in. He's gone, spread the word out. But I want to start with this first one. Obviously, we hang around with the guys a lot, but Craig Jones, probably the biggest name in Australian Jiu-Jitsu, massive. What's it like? What's it like being that person? Because when I talk to a lot of these guys, you know, you talk about Volk and Israel and them, they're just themselves, you know. They've always been that person, and then they just become famous. What was that like for you? That point when you were like, oh shit, I'm Craig Jones.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm not as famous as the MMA guys and stuff, right? But I think I have like a really weird fan base, mainly from probably the Instagram jokes and stuff. But I don't take it too seriously because I know it's going to fade away. You know, I feel like, especially when I compete and stuff, when people give you crazy amounts of compliments, I try to ignore that. So when they do say horrible things about me on the internet, I can sort of put that out of my mind as well. But yeah, it's pretty weird, but I do think like short-lived, you know, like I doubt anyone will remember me in like 5 years.
Yeah, I don't know how true that is. But was there like a point? Was there a point like obviously when you're coming up and you're like obviously overseas and you're training with DDS and all of them, was there like a point when it was like, oh man, like I'm getting a lot of attention. A lot of people are like just saying my name, or I'm walking down the street and they're like, hey, Craig Jones. Or what was that point when that started happening?
Well, actually it was ADCC 2017. And I faced Leandro Lowe. Like I had a crazy performance, like just, I think I was a plus 5,000 underdog. And after that, a lot of the jiu-jitsu Instagram pages just started making stupid memes about me, like Chuck Norris level memes and stuff. And they went viral. So I think that helped me a ton. And then straight after that, I had a match with Gordon at EBI. It was like the absolutes. And I had a crazy quick run of heel hooks before almost beating Gordon. I put him in an armbar, but the bastard wouldn't tap. I counted as a victory. And that one went viral as well. And straight after that was when I started getting, people started to recognize me. I reckon one of the first times, because it was an EBI event, so Eddie Bravo, so there's a lot of stoners there, and people were just giving me weed and strange things. And like I had to fly to New York the next day from Austin, Texas, where it was hosted. And I threw a bunch of this weed in my luggage that day. And when I got to the airport, I was picking up a rental car, and two guys in full military outfits with guns came up and tapped me on the shoulder. And I was like, oh fuck, a sniffer dog must've got me or something. But they just recognized me from the night before. And I remember being like, that's so strange.
Yeah, that is weird. Hey, and you've done some big things too. Like we're talking about before, like going on Joe Rogan. Like that's not a normal thing that most people do. Like what was that experience like going on there?
Well, that was crazy because I started listening to it when I was really young, like still living in my parents' house. I started listening to Rogan mainly because of his sort of jiu-jitsu connection with Eddie Bravo and stuff. But for me, I would have been super nervous to go on Rogan. But luckily, Volk's was in town and we were training together, and I went with him to the studio, right? And I didn't even think I was going on. And last second, Rogan was like, oh, you want to come on as well? So it was super relaxed, because it was like, I feel like a lot of people going on Rogan being like, fuck, don't say something stupid. Millions of people are going to hear this. But luckily for me, it was sort of like a last second thing.
Because Rogan's like quite a fan of yours, right? Like he's really into your jiu-jitsu. He talks about it quite a lot.
Yeah. Because of the Eddie Bravo connection, I feel like he disproportionately knew a lot of people that were on EBI. And then he became closer to us during COVID, because during COVID, Flow Grappling would host these Who's Number One events, and they would host it at the JW Marriott in Austin. And that's the same hotel where, I don't know if I should say this, where Rogan puts his guests up, right? But Rogan would come to those events, and he'd like come in late, and he'd watch sort of the co-main and main event and stuff like that. So that's where I first started to meet him, obviously introduce myself.
And how did it connect with Volk? Because obviously you're in the corner with Volk for all of his fights now, and like big part of his team, and did Ultimate Fighter. Did you guys connect at Ultimate Fighter? Do you guys have history before that, or how did that come to be?
He came down to Absolute MMA when I was still living in Melbourne, and we trained a few times down there. But where the connection started was I got this random message from him when I was living in Puerto Rico, and it was about the Ultimate Fighter, and he was like asking me to come on because I think Brad Riddell backed out at the last second. And I just was like, oh, I can get out of Puerto Rico for 5 weeks. Sign me up. And then obviously we trained together throughout that. Started preparing for the Ortega match during the filming of the show and stuff. I went in the corner for the Ortega match. I was definitely needed for the Ortega match. I think I was just carrying the bucket for the next two matches.
Yeah, that's right. Because it must have been COVID. Because I'm trying to put it together. But it would have been the time, and I don't know if this is even public knowledge, but there was a bunch of us that got COVID when Volk's fight fell through that March when he was meant to fight COVID. So a bunch of us, I think there was five of us, and I won't throw the other guys under the bus. I don't even know if that's known who it was, but there was me, Volk, and a couple others. And we had to stay in Vegas for like an extra 4 weeks. I remember when we were cleared to go home, he was like, oh, I'm going to do this Ultimate Fighter. So that's obviously when you guys connected and flew you back up.
Yeah, and he was like, I mean, because he'd been in Vegas so long, by the end of Ultimate Fighter, he was like, get me the fuck out of here. Like, I got to go back and see my family and stuff. It's so over.
Yeah, that's true. What was it like the first time you did the cornering with the UFC? Obviously, it's very different, right? Like, compared to all the grappling events and everything. Or was it similar? Or was it like, oh, I'm kind of comfortable here? Or what do you think of it?
I mean, there's just a ton more pressure, not just because there's more eyes on it, but I feel like it's very rare in jiu-jitsu for someone to take a bad injury. But like, I feel like with the MMA guys, you have a sense of responsibility for their health and well-being. So in that sense, I think I felt a lot more pressure. I've only cornered, I'm trying to think, I cornered 8 fights on the Ultimate Fighter. And then I've just cornered 3 UFC title fights. So I've never even...
What a record, hey.
I've cornered a title fight.
One of the best cornerman coaches in Australian history. What's it like? What do you think in terms of like jiu-jitsu for MMA? Like when you're with Volk and you're working it through, is that a fairly seamless transition when you're like, okay, these are moves and they're pretty relevant for MMA? Or is it, do you find that there's a separation, or is it difficult to integrate it? Or how do you find that?
Well, I think... They like for the Ortega fight, Ortega does a lot of jiu-jitsu specific moves that you really don't see in MMA. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people that try that style find it not very successful. You need a different style of grappling. And I think that's what makes Ortega so special, is because he can pull those things off in a fight. But I also think Ortega's durability, his ability to survive in a fight, gives him more options to catch these jiu-jitsu moves, whereas like his ability to take damage. But for the most part, I think that jiu-jitsu specific style of grappling is horrible for MMA. You know, if you're going to play off your back, obviously you don't submit the guy or get on top, you've lost the round. Like there's certain things like that, like trying to, like guard retention. If you try to put a guy in half guard or close guard, you're actually pinning yourself to the mat. So I think for the most part, a lot of MMA fighters that go, I need to learn how to grapple, and they go to a jiu-jitsu black belt, it's not going to be really beneficial to them. They're going to be teaching them things that make it very difficult to get back up off the ground.
What was going through your mind? Obviously, Volk throws a kick, Ortega catches it, jumps on top of him. It's deep. What's going through your head? Are you yelling out to him and coaching him in that moment? Or?
Well, the crowd was so loud. And obviously, he's deep in the choke. So, I mean, I don't think he's hearing a word we're saying, but obviously, we're freaking out in the corner. But there are a few things we went over, like Ortega's guillotine. Ortega has a lot of arm in, sort of choke variations, Das, Anaconda. And those things played a factor because we knew he would take high risk movements like that. And I know as soon as he got out of the guillotine, Ortega's in mount. He could have stayed in an excellent position, but he immediately allowed Volk to put him back to half guard, dove on like a Das choke, ended up on bottom, and ended up taking quite a bit of damage. So I think what makes Ortega so special is also what costs him sometimes like that. You know what I mean? Like he's going for a high risk move, which is obviously very scary, but obviously it's there's not a great payout if that doesn't work out for him.
If Ortega jumped on top of Craig Jones, locked you in a deep guillotine, what's happening?
I'll probably tap him, honestly.
Say, get me out of here. I don't get paid enough. That's Matt. ADCC just happened. Talk us through it. How'd it go?
ADCC, I secured another silver medal for this one. But how did it go for me? Day one went very well. First match against a Brazilian guy, I got a super quick submission. Second match against a 10th Planet guy who's been calling me out forever. This guy talks a ton of shit. He's actually a nice guy. I spoke to him with the after party, but he talks a ton of shit. And I was able to hit a guillotine on him. Day two, I faced off against a new wave guy. Super high pressure match. He's sort of not the replacement for me because he's much more accomplished than me in the sport of grappling. But I guess it was the first time I faced a new wave guy since the team split up. So obviously super high pressure, stressful match that one. Obviously my former coach, John Danaher's cornering against me, knows a lot about me, you know? So that's like, adds another challenge to it. Not to mention representing the new team versus the old team. And we had a pretty close match. I think I decisively did enough to win, but visually it looked closer than it was because I think we both got so tired throughout the match. And Merigali was doing a lot of things just to look busy. So things like he'd pick up a single leg and he wouldn't expend energy trying to put me down with it. He'd just let it go. But to the judges, it looks like he's securing stuff. So he's quite strategic. He's obviously IBJJF black belt, absolute world champion. So obviously one of the biggest titles in the gi, and I think that helps him tactically for these matches. And then in the final match, I faced off against Kynan, this human gorilla.
He's huge.
This huge guy. I remember I saw him getting IVs and I was like, fuck, it's under 99 kilos, man. Like, how big are you to be needing an IV to get to under 100? But yeah, that match went obviously horribly for me, but luckily the crowd was on my side and they were so vocal during the match. The referee kept giving him penalties. So in a 20-minute match, he got 8 penalties, which is 8 negative points. So it would be as if I started with an 8-point head start and still managed to lose the match.
It's wild, eh? What was it like with Danaher in the corner? Did you have to consider that when you guys were going into that match? Is it okay, I have to change the game plan for this, or is it just go with the flow?
I don't know. I mean, Danaher would have just been preparing him heel hook defense. I think he was smart of him to obviously assume I was going to chase after his legs straight away. And I really went aggressively after his legs because Merigali had talked shit in the lead up saying, I'll finish Craig in 3 to 4 minutes. And I was like, I'm going to try and finish this guy in 3 to 4 minutes. But yeah, apart from that, I try to put it out of my mind. Danaher, he wasn't the friendliest to me over the weekend. Like, we shook hands and stuff, but no conversation whatsoever.
I don't want to, we can edit this, eh, Bill? Like, if we go in, can we talk? Like, what was it like? We don't have to go into that. Obviously everyone's aware of the split, but you're obviously the top level guys in the jiu-jitsu community. Obviously you guys are the top level and you guys are in Austin as well. So there's no way you guys are not going to cross paths. Like, is it amicable? Can you guys be in the same room with each other?
Yeah. I mean, obviously we have to see each other and stuff around. I say hello to John, obviously, when I see him and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of personal problems through the split that not necessarily directly involved me. So, you know what I mean? So like, obviously when a thing happens like that, obviously if a band breaks up or something, people are picking sides and stuff. So obviously that's how it played out. But in terms of me having serious personal problems with anyone, like, I'm not really that type of person. But obviously the fans play it up because it's the old team versus the new team. That adds a lot of tension to things. You know what I mean? Like, if we ever lose, we get all these comments, you should have never left John Danaher. Look at you guys. You know what I mean? So obviously that plays a factor into the tension. Obviously the guy who Gordon portrays himself as, the character, obviously adds another dimension to it. But yeah, apart from that, I mean, the team obviously there's a completely different vibe between the B team and New Wave. You know what I mean? So like, I think that says a lot about why there are two teams today.
I was going to say, is it played up a lot? Because I know, like, I'm involved with the guys, and you know, at the end of the day, with the UFC, it's ticket sales, right? So you have to create a story and you have to create a drama. And it's the same for you guys. The more people that tune in, the more people that buy merch and everything else. Like, is it played up a bit? Like, do you?
Well, I don't think it's played up because we don't really talk about it. Neither side talks about it. There was an incident previously where Nicky Rod said some things that could have been perceived. Oh, I mean, he said some negative things about maybe John and Gordon, and that really fired up the split a bit at that time. But for the most part, we keep everything pretty private. So obviously, like, if we're keeping it close to our chest and not using it for media attention or to hype up potential matches, obviously there's going to be some real things that happen there. And I would say, a lot of people ask me about it all the time, and I would just say, like, it's probably not my story to tell, if that makes sense. You know, like, it doesn't directly involve me as much as others. So in that sense, like, I can't really talk about it.
Yeah.
It might come out one day, though, you know. I might write a book about it, make some money one day, because people are very interested.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you're all professionals, too. Like, you see it in every sport. There's always, like, drama, and there's, like, yeah, like you said, you could write so many books. Like, I know with the athletes, there's always things going on. You could always do it. It's like, the public usually play it up so much more than what it actually is. But we're talking about ADCC. I find it crazy because obviously I'm so heavily involved with UFC, and everywhere you go, there's like state athletic commissions. Like, you've got to jump through so many hoops. You got to do through so, and they're so strict. USADA is knocking on the door every other minute. Jiu-Jitsu, and in particular ADCC, me looking at it as like the scientist nerdy dude being like, oh, we do these weight cuts, do it right. Is crazy. It's the wild, wild west. What's it like when you get in there? Like you were saying, some of the things you said before about guys with oxygen masks, it sounds bonkers.
Oh, it's chaos. I mean, any sport where there's guys over 40-year-old looking absolutely shredded and performing, obviously you're gonna wonder what's happening there. But like, something that was crazy for me is like, I won't name names, but guys were coming off the mats going straight on oxygen tanks and stuff like that. I'm like, what's going on here? Obviously, Mo Jassim, who runs ADCC, provided IVs for all the athletes and stuff. Again, something you wouldn't see in MMA because it's going to dilute drug tests, but obviously no drug tests whatsoever for ADCC. And like that's why I think it's like the Wild West, and also why I think it has this unique appeal, because it's kind of like a lawless sort of thing, almost like Pride was back in Japan and stuff. You see these guys looking like bodybuilders and stuff. It's wild.
And it's such a spectacle nowadays too. It's like, how many people were at ADCC this year, do you think?
12,000.
Like, that's insane for a jiu-jitsu event, right? Like, and it's not like it's a 12,000 placid, quiet fans. Like, they're into it. It's almost like they're the old, or the just bleed UFC fans from back in the day. The dudes are just be up screaming because they're so into it. And like, the appeal, right? Like, we just had some weird dude. I'm not going to say weird dude, take that back. Some fan who just walked through the door here. Like, it's crazy how much appeal it has these days.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting. Is like, I would say the fan base is huge. The fan base for the sport is huge. But in terms of actual athletes that have real fans, there's only a select few, because like some of the athletes would go out into the crowd and obviously no one would recognize them. And then others are obviously getting just mobbed by fans. So I think that's crazy in and of itself, is that like there's so many fans there, but they really only know a few of these actual competitors.
Why do you think that is? Because obviously you've done very successful, and you're, again, it's like at the top level, you are playing a character to an extent, because like, it's your job, right? And that's how you make money in the world. Like, why is it that the jiu-jitsu guys just don't buy into it?
Yeah, I think some of the guys spent so much time training that they have no social skills, no ability to talk at all. They do interviews, they say the exact same thing as everyone else, which happens in MMA too. Sometimes MMA guys take it the other way, and it's almost so cringe that they still don't really resonate with any of the fans. I just saw a unique opportunity, because the sport was full of fake humility, guys that sort of, yeah, just say the same things over and over again. I saw a unique opportunity to take it in the other direction. You know what I mean? To sort of make a joke of what it is, because it is kind of silly. It's just a bunch of dudes wrestling each other that are talking about how jiu-jitsu saved their lives. You know what I mean? So I saw it as an opportunity to just head in the other direction, make a complete mockery of it. And across cultural barriers, some of the Brazilians don't really find that funny whatsoever. They really don't like those jokes. Yeah.
Yeah, that is so true. And I think in terms of jiu-jitsu, we were talking about this earlier, when we compare it to MMA, like with what I do, the sports science side of it, it's funny because jiu-jitsu has been around for a long time, but they're so far behind with so many things. And we're talking about this before, guys coming off, getting oxygen chambers, like IVs everywhere. ADCC for me, especially since we've been working together and I'm looking at it so much more and dealing with so much athletes, it's wild how far behind the times jiu-jitsu are. Like, why is that? Why is it? Is that, and I almost feel that they're resistant to the idea of, hey, you know what? Whereas in MMA, the guy's almost open to it. They're like, okay, yeah, if you, my diet will work and make me better. And if I lift these weights and do this, I'll be able to kick harder. And, you know, if I run on this treadmill at this speed for this amount of time, my gas tank will be better. I find with the jiu-jitsu guys, they're not that into all that.
Yeah, jiu-jitsu guys are resistant to a ton of things. I think first and foremost, it comes from Brazil, where they have an attitude of just train harder, just push through anything. You know what I mean? Another reason is a lot of the guys are so broke, they can't hire any professional help whatsoever. Other factors, I think you get a lot of these guys in jiu-jitsu gyms, a coach thinks he's like an expert in all things. You know what I mean? Like, there'll be lawyers, doctors in his class, but he's sort of like, he thinks he's the gatekeeper of knowledge to everything. So he'll like tell these guys bad things about strength conditioning, nutrition, obviously weight cutting as well. I think that's a huge factor. And as well, guys that do jiu-jitsu started off doing jiu-jitsu. They never did any other sports, whereas MMA has like wrestlers, even guys from the NFL and stuff, sports with sports science. They trust those sports scientists' sort of knowledge base. But jiu-jitsu guys just have no access to that. You know what I mean? They're not coming from those sports where they have educated people to listen to.
Do you feel it now that we've gone through, like, and we went through and we did that diet and everything, and do you feel like there's a difference? Because when I talk to jiu-jitsu guys and we do work with them, I almost think that's a massive advantage, right? Like, because like you said, so many of them don't do it. And in MMA, it's almost seems that everyone's doing it, where the advantage you're going to get over the next guy, because you know that they're ticking all the boxes. So it's like, man, you got to do it just so you can work hard in the gym and get better than that guy. Whereas for the BJJ guys and other combat sports who aren't as in tune with it, I almost say to them, like, man, like, you can get a leg up on them by just doing this. And all you have to do is lift weights a few times, eat the right meals, and then run on the treadmill a couple of times.
Oh, for sure. I mean, even basic things like hydration, you know, like getting the right hydration if you're going to be training multiple times a day, like getting the electrolytes in, that alone is huge, let alone the benefits of like the protein timing and stuff we did. And like, again, jiu-jitsu guys aren't like wrestlers or MMA guys. I would say objectively, those guys are not lazy. But there's a lot of lazy jiu-jitsu guys. Like, I've been guilty of it at times where I'll just be like, I just can't be fucked eating, you know? I'll just go to the gym, push through. But I end up training light to avoid pushing myself too hard, or I try to push myself too hard and as a result end up sick, staff, or just training terribly.
Run down. What was it like at ADCC this year, especially around the weight cutting? Because the format's bizarre. I'll say it very publicly. I think the format is very bizarre how they weigh in at ADCC, but whatever, it works. But even when I'm working with the guys, it makes it a bit more tricky to navigate. And to me, I'm thinking, man, you've really got to be on top of this to make this bizarre format work in your favor and not get fucked up by it and not get really messed up. Did you see it? Were the guys out there? Because I was watching some matches going, oh man, I think that guy's had a rough one to the scale and it's probably showing.
Oh, definitely. Because we got to weigh in on the Friday morning, Saturday morning, Sunday morning too. So it's like those three-day weigh-ins. And like when we spoke about it initially about me doing 88 kilos, like you were giving me the advice that really we don't want to cut much water at all. You know, that's not going to be a great idea for the event. We're talking about things like cutting fiber and stuff. But you see guys out there that are just doing massive water cuts on consecutive days in a row and just taking a huge toll on their body. And like a lot of those matches were decided by cardio. Like a lot of the time the skill level's so close that the guys can't submit each other. And the way ADCC point scoring works is it's very hard to score points. So a lot of the matches were decided by cardio, and obviously a weight cut and just general nutrition is going to be a huge factor in that.
Yeah. I even remember back when I was competing a lot, it was a bizarre thing because you, not that you were expected to cut weight, but there wasn't really, if you did it, any negative, or no one would really come up to you and be like, hey man, like you got absolutely smashed. And it was probably because of the weight cut. It was always, hey man, you got absolutely smashed. We got to work on this in the gym. We just wouldn't talk about it. And it was like, oh yeah, okay. Like it wasn't that, you know, I didn't have the right technique with this choke or whatever. I got to go work on that. Let's ignore the fact that I haven't eaten a carb in 6 weeks. And I was in a bathtub for 4 hours before I got here and haven't looked at fluid for 24 hours. It's absolutely crazy. But that's almost like the culture at a lot of gyms now, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. Like guys will just be doing bizarre things, you know, like you ask them, where did you learn to do this? And they'll name like another jiu-jitsu guy. And you're like, well, that's not, just because he's good at jiu-jitsu doesn't mean he's qualified to help you in these areas. And even jiu-jitsu guys in terms of cardio, they don't want to do extra cardio. It's like they think jiu-jitsu is so unique in that sense that they refuse to do anything outside. And I think you saw a lot of the guys that did extra cardio and took more professional steps actually perform much better at ADCC.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I noticed that when I got into high level MMA working with guys, is a lot of people made the mistake of thinking, oh, this guy's exceptionally good at MMA, so he must be doing everything right. And I definitely fell for that trap when I started jiu-jitsu, like the senior guys at the gym, and I did terrible weight cuts or like terrible training in general, or like just everything, many other things I did terrible off the advice and the influence of these senior guys. But it's absolutely true, right? Like you look at them and you go, oh man, this guy's a black belt at the gym, and he just told me not to drink water for 48 hours. I'm probably not going to drink water for 48 hours. And then there's nowhere really to go and get that information and find it and be like, yeah, no, that's probably the most worst thing you could possibly do.
Oh, for sure. That information is not out there. And like most jiu-jitsu gyms don't really have a lot of MMA fighters that have had experience in weight cuts, let alone had experience in good weight cuts. Obviously, there's still tons of MMA fighters out there that are doing stupid, horrible things to make the weight. So yeah, in terms of where to find that information, it's not really out there until obviously what we've put out recently.
Yeah, and we'll go over it, but I want to break it down because a lot of people, when we put out that we're working together, they're like, man, Greg's not even cutting weight for this one. Like he gets to eat whatever. And the funny thing when I explained it to him, and I went through it with a lot of people, and like a lot of my weekend Q&As are like blasphemy questions like, man, why is Craig eating this? Why is Craig eating that? And you're like, it always really amazes me. I don't want to say like the lack of knowledge because it's not there. And I always say you can't blame these guys for not having access to the knowledge, because I think of like my coach and everything that he's done for me. It's not his fault that he doesn't have all of this knowledge about nutrition, because it's just, how is he going to get it? He's not going to go to uni and do like a 4, 5, 6 year degree. His coach definitely didn't do that. Like his coach was just eating KFC and whatever else, and that's what he saw. But so many people, like when we were doing our diet, you were getting in 5,000 calories a day. And like to break down what 5,000 calories looks like. And if you want to do that with chicken and rice and veg, like that old school bodybuilding diet, which I think is getting kind of popular in jiu-jitsu in a weird way, because I think there's a few prominent figures that very much look like bodybuilders, and it's definitely making a comeback. But getting 5,000 cals in that way, one, is just insane to do, like eating that much food, and you'll feel terrible. Like if you feel terrible eating all of that, it's such a huge volume of food. And so like what we were doing, like going to In-N-Out and going getting burrito bowls, because you just simply have to make up those calories. What was that like going over that process for you?
Obviously it was a bit of an adjustment period at the start, but like you push through and obviously your body does adapt to it. You know, like when I first started hitting 5,000 calories, I felt like I couldn't even move on the mats, let alone play guard. Like I felt like my stomach was so full. I'd be pouring with sweat. I'd be out of breath. But then as the body adapts to it, that extra energy really helped me throughout especially the later rounds in each session. You know, like I was a guy that would just skip breakfast before class. Like I always figured like it would feel better to train with an empty stomach. You know what I mean? But then obviously you're depleted when you're accessing those energy systems, especially later.
Yeah, so that less is more attitude, hey? And it's not just jiu-jitsu. Every combat sport, heaps of athletes have it. It's like less is more. And it's like, I need to look like an athlete. And to look like an athlete, I need to get super shredded. And to do that, I just need to eat a peanut or two every other day and then go train the house down, train 5-6 hours. It's just not sustainable. It just kills you, right? And it's like, that's, and it's a big reason like for this course. And I don't want to be too pushy with it, but it's more so because like I've been there, I've done it myself. I've been through that crappy period. And then even when I'm coming in and seeing, you know, the B team and guys at the top levels for, not even just jiu-jitsu, top level UFC guys as well. It's like, man, you guys could be so much better and could be making the most of this training and recovery, simply just putting the better food in your mouth, putting better food at the right time, and everything could be so much easier for you.
And I would say a big thing for me is since I've started the diet, I haven't had staph. And I know a lot of people will say staph's 100% a hygiene issue, but I think staph is sort of a overtraining, under recovery sort of issue. I think when you're vulnerable at those times, obviously unhygienic gym, you're going to catch staph. But for me, when I wasn't getting the right nutrition and wasn't recovering, I would be more vulnerable. I remember when I was in New York, I got staph 10 times in 12 months. And that was just obviously a dirty gym, but you know what I mean? But just not taking my nutrition serious at all and not recovering. My body was just, I was just smashing my body. And I think that was a symptom of not taking my recovery seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just being run down, immunocompromised, right? You see it all the time in all athletes' back end of fight camp. Like how many times have you been 2-3 weeks out from a comp and you catch a flu, you just can't kick it, or like you get an infection and just like, well, even everything. People don't realize like your sleep goes to shit if you don't have good nutrition. Everything goes down, and it's simply by just underfueling for way too long. So I think, what would you think if there's guys out here from the gym? I'm sure guys would have looked at you and eating, even at B team, and been like, dude, what are you doing? What was it like? What was the reception from all the other guys in the gym when they're seeing, especially, I know we weren't cutting weight for this, but a lot of the guys were. Like, what was their response when you're like, hey, I'm doing this, I'm getting this diet on board?
Well, I mean, some of the guys that were cutting a ton of weight were jealous and shit. And obviously that would pry into their perceptions and stuff. And they'd be like, you're just eating horrible food. But it's like, it's the totality of the day's nutrition. You know what I mean? Like, whereas like if I'm like, I know our in and out meal would be 2000 calories, you know, like because we're trying to get the 5000 calories in. That's like a calorie dense meal. We had to get that in. But as a whole, with all the extra supplements and stuff we're taking, the shakes, I mean, for me, I didn't get sick. I got sick once during the camp, but that was like a stomach bug, obviously just purely contagious. But like, typically speaking, if I'm pushing hard for something like a super fight or a tournament coming up, I will 100% at some point catch a cold, catch staph. And obviously with this diet that people are looking at being like, he's eating shit food, they would assume that there's going to be negative consequences. But I actually felt better than I've ever felt. And I actually stayed the course for training. I was able to train basically 7 days a week and didn't get sick, didn't have any issues of that sort, no injuries even.
Yeah, I think that was the most asked question I got during that whole time. Like every weekend I do these Q&As on my show, and I'd get like 20 questions like, why is Craig eating in and out? And it's like, man, he's eating other things other than just in and out. Like we're getting it all in. But it's a big misconception, right? And I think people just don't understand how it works with your body, because yeah, if you're just eating all in and out, yeah, for sure. And you're overdoing it. Absolutely. But like, you've got to, like you said, take the right supplements. You got to get the right nutrients in, and you got to time it properly. It's not just as simple as, okay, like I just trained for 5-6 hours and now I'm going to boot to in and out after, and that's it. And that's going to be my only meal for the day.
I would obviously play it up a little bit too, to stir people up a bit and stuff, you know, but like, obviously we got the DEXA scan done and what was it? It was 12 pounds of lean mass, 4 pounds of fat gained. So it's obviously those calorie dense things I'm eating, I'm burning that away. You know what I mean? So I'm doing enough exercise to burn that off, as opposed to like, if you just eat in and out every day and don't do anything, that's probably going to look different over the course of 3 months.
What do you think moving forward? Are you planning on cutting weight? Are you planning on maintaining? Like, how did you feel at this weight when you were competing there? Like, was it good with your body?
I felt good, but I just ultimately felt like I didn't necessarily belong in that weight division. You know what I mean? So I saw it like, I could do it, but I think I would have to, obviously we were running on finite time because Isaac won Asian trials and that only left me really like just over 2 months. And obviously I gained that weight, gained it very quick, and I did feel good at that weight. But when you're dealing with guys like Kynan and Marigali who are cutting down, I wasn't cutting any weight. So obviously I think the heaviest I got was 220. I got the stomach bug, fell back a bit. I think I weighed in 97 kilos for ADCC. And obviously I'm dealing with guys that are taking IVs to get under 99 kilos. So I think personally, I'll probably move back to 88 for the next one.
What's your thoughts about obviously going through that, like since going through this process, like what is 88? Because I remember the first time we spoke and we were talking about getting to 88 even, I was like, oh man, this might be a bit of a, not because you can't do it. It's like you can make the weight, but it's like, should you make the weight? And I think it's hard when you're just taking someone and they've never gone through, hey, these are the principles of the diet you need to go through. And this is how you actually get this weight off your body. You got to hit these amount of calories. And then when we get to that few days coming in, hey, we don't actually want to cut water weight and we want to manipulate all that. And I definitely feel now that we've done it and you've done it, staying at 99 kgs, getting down to 88 will be a piece of pie because you know the process, right? You know all the principles.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, seeing some of the guys like that cut a lot of corners at ADCC and you saw how it affected their performance, obviously that encourages you to stick to the plan much more because the consequences on, I guess, your health and mental well-being around the around a tournament like that, it's going to play a huge factor. But for me, that last ADCC, I caught EKC, which is viral pink eye, which is absolutely horrible. It broke out in the jiu-jitsu sport at the time, permanently blinded the vision in one of my eyes. Like I used to have perfect 20/20, and that one's just, it's still pretty good, but obviously I got some scarring in there or something. But like what made the weight cut extra bad for the last one was I was cutting water and I had to be in the hot sauna with this horrible pink eye. My eye was just burning the whole time. And I was just like, what the fuck am I doing? This sport's disgusting.
It is bad. Eh? Speaking of those bad weight cuts, you've told us before in the past, what are some of the worst ones you've done making weight? Because you've already done it and you've had like a pretty accomplished career and you would have seen some crazy, crazy stuff as well.
Yeah, usually the bad ones would be like I get injured or I get sick and my weight ends up being too high. Like for that ADCC in particular, because I caught the viral pink eye, I couldn't train because it's so contagious. It's so contagious that I believe if I were to touch my eye and touch a surface, it can survive on that surface for like a month at a time. So obviously I wasn't willing to ask a training partner that didn't have it and be like, hey man, can you help me prepare? Like I'm going to mess up their eye. So that one I couldn't train maybe a week before. So obviously that made the weight cut much, much worse. But in terms of just stupid things I've done, I would say just cutting water before an IBJJF one. And an IBJJF one is they call your name, you weigh in, you compete. So I've literally, there's no rehydration whatsoever. And then obviously the same thing everyone else has done, go no carbs for way too long. And that brings you to a point of like suicidal thoughts. I don't know how people do it. Do those zero carb diets and shit. I just feel like that's impossible in a sporting environment.
Yeah, I think we'll wrap it up soon. What are the biggest things? And the reason I want to get it out there, like I don't want to feel like we're doing like too pushy with this stuff. I just think coming from a jiu-jitsu background too, especially moving into MMA, it blows my mind just how much easier everyone's life could be if, and they don't even need to go like hire a professional, hey, to do it. Like just how much easier everyone's life would be if they just did some pretty basic things, like get the right amount of calories in, if they knew how important carbs are for the sport of jiu-jitsu and they knew how many carbs to get in. Like you said, the protein pacing and then rehydration, like things like that could just make your life so, so, so much easier. If we were to wrap it up and say, like, what were the biggest things that you took away from it? And say someone comes up to you in the gym, they go, hey, Craig, like, I want to get on your In-N-Out diet. Like, what were the biggest things you learned being on that diet?
I mean, I would just say take it. You should be taking it seriously, whether you're a coach or an athlete. Like, I think all athletes should have a personal responsibility to do everything they can, you know what I mean? To not cut corners, especially as a sport. The sport's clearly becoming much more professional, you know what I mean? So this would be a way to have an edge. And if you as a coach are responsible for a group of students, I think you should invest in the knowledge for yourself, because you don't want to be giving them bad advice because it can have negative health consequences, but also you want to give your guys any edge possible. And like I say, we're heading in a professional direction. And I think if people don't start taking these aspects serious, they could be left behind. It could be detrimental to their team. And ultimately for jiu-jitsu, I think it's, sometimes the best guys are the guys that were able to spend the most time on the mat. So obviously we lose a lot of guys to injuries. If you don't take your recovery seriously, your nutrition seriously, I think you're more susceptible to injuries. Not to mention, like I said, I used to get sick a lot during training camps and I used to get staff a lot. And obviously that's time off the mats. And I really do think taking your nutrition serious, and I saw that effect because I didn't get sick leading up to this camp. So I was able to maximize my time on the mats. And when you look at an ADCC match, that's neck and neck, it's down to the wire. And it's maybe who's got that last final push. And I really felt that in my match with Merigali. We had a crazy scrap for the first 4 minutes. My attacking, my pacing was off because it was obviously a little personal with the shit talk, former teammate. So my pacing was off. I went crazy. Luckily, he gassed defending that stuff. And I remember we were pushing. It was a 15-minute match. And I was timing myself. I knew I had one big push left in me. You know what I mean? I had something left in the gas tank. And I was able to shoot a takedown, put him to a hip. And that's ultimately what I think won the match. So I think if you see how these things come down to the wire, I think you can't help but not take all these aspects seriously. Obviously, we're talking about the nutrition program, but I even believe strength and conditioning, cardio, you should be doing all those things to the best of your ability.
Yeah, we were talking about it earlier, like jiu-jitsu kind of is the pride right now. It's at least in that phase, but look where something like the UFC and MMA went since it was there, right? And I feel like jiu-jitsu, at least from where I'm sitting and more on like the business side and looking at it, it's getting crazy, crazy professional. Like even see on the local circuits now, like they're doing like jiu-jitsu only grappling events and they're getting, you know, lots and lots of people and they're selling tickets. Like you never saw that 5-10 years ago. It's crazy how fast it's growing and it's just becoming so professional. Like you said, it's almost becoming like the team sport now, and there's so much opportunity for teams to get around and make a big name for themselves. And one thing I've noticed, at least when I've been in the MMA scene and associating with like City Kickboxing and Freestyle MMA, this type of stuff is something they took really seriously really early on. Like we're seeing it at the B team now. Now you guys are starting to jump on it. You're starting to see like these results, hey? And it's crazy. I think that's where the sport of jiu-jitsu is heading. But I want to get your thoughts. Last question, second last question actually. Where do you think the sport is going? 5 to 10 years, like where do you see it being?
I think it's going to keep up sort of the trajectory it's on right now, because it's like even ADCC 2013 was in China and there would have been 20 people in the crowd. The first ADCC I did in Brazil, I think maybe 500 people in the crowd. But like over time, they're getting bigger and bigger audience. Now we're at 12,000. I know for a fact, I don't know if I meant to say it, but if Mo hosts the next ADCC, he's obviously going to take a bigger arena, and I think probably 20,000 people in the seats. And people were talking about how jiu-jitsu is always going to be held back because it's a participant sport. Only people that participate in it will actually watch these events. But I think as more MMA guys get involved, more bigger names, crossover grappling matches, sort of things like that, we do get more, a bigger fan base, more non-participant sort of spectators of these events, you know. And I think if it keeps heading in that direction, then obviously growth is endless.
Yeah, absolutely. I think last question, probably pretty good time. We were talking earlier and we were going to do the world's first announcement. So I'm happy that you're going to do it on the podcast, the super fight. Gabby Garcia said it's happening. let everyone know the date.
Oh, yeah. I know. She keeps losing, though. She keeps losing. She's really let us down. She obviously lost to ADCC. I don't know if we're having a big super fight, but the fans want it. Eventually, I'm just going to show up at her gym and I'll fight her at her gym.
Yeah. And I think when she beats you, we're going to be having a performance nutrition with Gabby Garcia.
I wonder what her nutrition looks like.
Yeah. Probably a bit different. I can have a guess with it. But Craig, thanks for coming on. I know you're busy. Last thing before I let you go. We'll probably get this out pretty shortly, but guys in Australia, I don't know if you're doing privates or anything, events. Like obviously we just had someone run through our front door to come see you when they drove past. People want to see, is there places they can catch you over the next few days? Or are you doing anything? It is true.
Three in Brisbane sold out. I've got one in Melbourne sold out, one in Adelaide sold out. So it's just gone crazy.
This is the last thing I want to talk, like quickly mention on this podcast. I didn't realize when I dropped over to see you in Texas, there were dudes in the airport and I was absolutely convinced they were Aussies. I knew it for sure, but they had like jiu-jitsu gear and I was like, they're definitely coming to see you. Guys just drop in all the time, right? That's the thing. And like, you guys are all cool with that. Cause I've had people ask me, be like, oh, can I just drop into B team and go see him? Or is there like this weird thing?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We welcome all the tourists, you know, like B team to become a member. you sort of have to be invited, but anyone can drop in. So we sort of, we keep the team itself pretty small, but anyone can drop in. And it's actually funny, a ton of Aussies are coming in and a ton of people from immigration don't believe their stories. So I keep getting calls from immigration. They're like, hey, we've got such and such here for 3 months to train with you. Like, they just don't believe it. Like, people at border security and stuff would be like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. What were you saying that one time when you used to go through and they'd pull you up? They'd be like, what do you do for a job?
Oh, yeah. I'd come through and they'd be like, what are you here for, jiu-jitsu? I'd be like, are you making money off it? I'd be like, I wish. They'd be like, come on through.
Get in there, Tiger. Have a crack. Welcome to the land of dreams. All right, Craig, that's good. So I think we'll wrap that up there. But we have dropped that new course if you guys are watching, Performance Nutrition for BJJ. Pretty much, we just go over everything that we just spoke about, way more depth. We talk about the principles that Craig used. Again, I say, I know we're pushing it, but I've just seen this in MMA. I've seen it in other sports. I've seen how just making these small changes make such a big difference when it comes to your competition and when you're getting out there and actually jumping on the mat. And I think if Craig Jones can do it and he can pull it off, then anyone can do it. So if you're going to go on that, we'll put a link up and we'll put a little discount code up. But Craig, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
And there it is, another episode of the TFD Performance Podcast. If you like this episode and you enjoy our content, then you will absolutely love our new TFD Performance Hub. Our first course on the Hub is the Performance Nutrition for BJJ course, which is perfect for grapplers looking to master their nutrition. And if you follow the link in the description, you can even snag 40% off that course. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and if you follow along our socials at @the_fightdietitian, all of the best bits from our podcast episodes. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the TFD Performance Podcast.